Yes, I am recording. Yes. I will record this and share it. Thank you very much for that, Zoe. I'd like to ask all of you to keep your microphones on mute as we go through it, except for whoever's speaking. And for the participants, if you'd like to contribute during the Q&A session, then just mention that in the chat. And if you've got any questions as well, just put them in the chat and Davide and I will monitor that. I'd also like to thank everyone who submitted questions in the JOT form, and especially to those who have shared resources or solutions to those questions. And I will share that document at the end of the session with everyone. So to start off, we've got, like I said, three fantastic speakers. First off, we have Zoe, who is a PhD researcher from LSE. She specializes in digital ethnography, focusing on YouTube, and is currently doing an autoethnography of becoming a YouTuber. And so she'll be talking to you a bit about the digital ethnography side of things. Then we have Callan Cole from Stripe Partners. Stripe's a very interesting organization. It's a company that does ethnographic research to provide industrial insights for organization. And Callan himself specializes in online behavior and emerging technologies. So he has expertise in the more applied research side of ethnography. And finally, we have Eivor Obon from Warwick Business School. Eivor has a wide range of interests, focusing on innovation and digital technology, and has experience with ethnography in more remote, difficult to access areas as well. So I think that's everything that I needed to cover in the introduction. So I'll pass on to Zoe. Zoe, can you tell us a bit about yourself and your research, please?
Yeah, hello. Thank you for having me. It's very nice to talk to some people and also to talk about digital ethnography. I'm glad that this is, I mean, it's unfortunate what's happening at the moment, but I'm glad that the thing that I was already doing can be of use to other people. So as Illa said, I am a third year PhD student in the Department of Media and Communications at LSE. I am doing an ethnographic study. I'm now in the third year of doing the ethnographic study at research itself. Basically, I'm studying the experiences and labor of YouTube content creators and the broader online video industry. And I've used a lot of different methods, including both online and offline ethnography. I know some people had asked a question about combining online and offline, so I can speak to that. Online across lots of different platforms and offline at mostly industry events in the US and the UK. I've also interviewed 31 content creators, some of which have been on Skype, most of which have been in person. And I also do autoethnography in the form of becoming a YouTuber myself. So all of these different things have come together basically to form one big research project about the experiences of YouTube creators. And I think probably the reason why I was invited here today is because, aside from my own research, I am the founder of the LSE Digital Ethnography Collective. So we, a bit similar to this actually, we do events every, well, usually every 2 weeks, but obviously recently not so often, around various different issues relating to digital ethnography, including things like ethics, data analysis, stuff like that, research challenges, various different things. And we have some resources which I can share with you that might be useful, such as a collaboratively produced reading list, which is about, I think it's about 17 pages now, but people keep adding stuff to it. And it has lots of good empirical examples of digital ethnography, but also sections on things like ethics resources, like practical methods resources, stuff like that. We also live stream our meetings, our events usually, and so I can send a link. You can watch any of those sessions on YouTube. That's it, I think. Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Zoe, can you tell us a bit about how your research has been affected, if at all, by the pandemic?
Yeah. Luckily for me, I had done most of my data collection before the pandemic started. I was meant to be going to LA in June for another field trip, but I guess one of the upsides of doing a very long-term ethnographic study is that, I've already done 3 years worth of data collection, so it hasn't impacted my project too badly, but because it combines online and offline, I can also just turn to the online a bit more heavily. I think the balance of different types of data is yet to be seen in the write-up. Like, I'm writing up now, so I can kind of choose how heavily I want to give one part of my data weight. And I expect that because of this situation, there will be more of the online stuff, but actually, luckily, not too bad.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Zoe. Can we hear a bit from Callan about, can you introduce yourself, Callan, and tell us a little bit about the work that you do and how, if at all, that's been affected by the pandemic and what you're doing to address that?
Yeah, definitely. And thanks for inviting me today. And I think it's going to be an interesting discussion. I'm really excited to hear what everyone else has to share and what people's questions are as well. As you said in the introduction, I work for Stripe Partners, which is a company of about 20 people based in London. And we are mostly kind of people from anthropology backgrounds. The vast majority of kind of research consultants have studied anthropology, and that's really where our kind of interests lie. All of our research is for like corporate clients and trying to help them figure out kind of strategy and innovation. So we try to use an ethnographic approach to qualitative research. And going out to get a better understanding of users, consumers, and kind of how different products or services relate to the way that they make meaning for themselves and in the kind of rich context and worlds of their day-to-day life, rather than the way that businesses kind of tend to see things. A lot of it is in the tech sector. So I'm currently on a project based on trying to understand the needs of small businesses and how small businesses collaborate and communicate and what their needs are. We were supposed to go to India and Brazil. To do that, a lot of our work is kind of multi-country projects, and we're kind of always going into the field, usually for kind of a week per market to do that research. Obviously, now we can't, and so we've really shifted to doing video interviews and kind of digital diary style activities. And interactions and things of that nature. So definitely trying to adjust to it, but yeah, learning a lot from needing to switch to Zoom and everything and trying to use these technologies, which were, always there, but we weren't using them before. So it's been a learning experience, definitely.
Great. Yeah, I think there's a lot of people who will be moving to digital technologies. I think we have a lot of questions around that and the ethics of it and how to keep participants engaged. So I think when we do the Q&A session, you can definitely speak to that, and we look forward to hearing it. And finally, we have Eivor. Eivor, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and your work?
Hello. Yes, my name is Eivor, and I guess a little bit of an outlier here in that I certainly don't focus solely on ethnographic work, but my research is around organizing and I do use ethnographic methods, though qualitative inquiry is sort of my broader approach. My topic has generally been to study within the range of healthcare, and healthcare currently has a number of disruptions through COVID, as you can imagine. So the disruptions for me are actually, for my healthcare related projects, are in addition to the issue of access, is that people's roles have changed, people are too busy, people are overwhelmed. And so there are other issues related to the crisis that people who are doing this kind of work are also facing. So it's interesting to understand the motivation behind the different research projects. And I find that now I'm looking at my theoretical interest a bit more closely with the different projects, trying to see how I might shift them, either because of access issues or because there are other issues of organization that seem more interesting. My general interest has been around how technology is being used to facilitate organization. And now with crisis, there are also implications of sort of new theoretical areas. So I'm engaging a bit more with the crisis literature. I'm trying to understand safety and what that means. There are different stakeholders who perceive it differently. And so I guess my one message, and I certainly agree with what Kaylin and Zoe have already said, I guess the one point I would add is that it's a time to reflect on different theoretical possibilities and think about what new areas of one's topic, so in my case, organizing, and we're still all organizing, but we are doing it very differently. And so it's a unique opportunity to study organizing in sort of maybe a context of crisis, or you could think of different ways to frame it. But that would be my sort of background and reaction to what's currently going on in this crisis. I guess I would also just note, Ila, you had suggested that I tend to do research in did you say faraway places or developing country context? So I do look at sort of the carbon market in East Africa. So the carbon trade, growing of trees and producing better oxygen, if you will, and also smart village movements in India. And certainly the challenge of the physical travel to these sites, which these were both more ethnographic in nature, that has really changed what's possible with some of that research. And I can elaborate on that if you want later.
Okay, so I think we can start to go into question answer mode. The ethos of the Ethnography Circle is that this is a self-help group. So there are no experts. So I will put up the questions. We have three people who have experience. So we invited Callan, Zoe, and Aver because they have experience doing certain things. But if there's anybody else in the groups who would like to contribute, please come in. And if you have any other questions, just put them on the group chat and we'll pass them on, okay? So again, it's called the Ethnographer Circle. It's not the Ethnographer Classroom for a reason. Okay, so what we did is that before, as you all know, before the meeting, we collected a number of questions and we very quickly content analyzed them, so that we can respond to or at least pose the questions that most people had. And we have three questions we're gonna go through, three sets. One has to move toward digital ethnography. So for those who haven't done it. One is about the issues of access and participants. Obviously it's tricky for those who have not started in the digital format, how to involve and get access. And the third one is how to deal with the disruption. What have you done? What have we done? I know that Zoe has been involved in conversations. I met her during a Twitter storm a few weeks ago. And Zoe has very interesting, I think, views about what to do and what not to do. For example, should you jump on the COVID bandwagon or not? I happen to agree with Zoe. So we're gonna go through these three groups of curiosity first. And I'll give, so I invite Zoe, Callan, and Aver to to put out the view first, but then please, everybody else can come in. So the first one is, we had a lot of people who are less familiar with the world of doing ethnography online. Most of the people that I know that come to the ethnography circle are quite traditional, inverted commas, so observation-based. So I think that if you, especially Callan and Zoe, if you can help us a little bit navigate between the difference between digital ethnography, netnography, cyber ethnography. If you give an example from your work, and if anybody else has done these things, please do come in, raise your hand, and come in and share with others. So we get a sense of what is this doing. Because otherwise, you know, we read all these labels, and without examples, it's difficult to understand what this word. It's good for me.
I can start if you like. So yeah, I think there's been a lot of terms around the idea of digital ethnography. It started in the 90s, so obviously it meant something quite different back then. And like with most things, there's been like a proliferation of different terms that have quite subtle differences usually in terms of what they actually refer to. But I guess the pressures on academics to come up with novel ideas means that sometimes people kind of come up with new terms when it's not necessary. But there are some meaningful distinctions. I'm just looking at the list here that you already mentioned them, but I see, okay, so we've got blurred boundaries of, yeah, remote ethnography, digital ethnography, online ethnography, cyber ethnography, virtual ethnography, and netnography. As far as, in my opinion, like there's probably three main groups there that I think are actually distinct. Cyber and virtual ethnography usually refer to online only ethnography. So like classic books like Tom Belstorff's Coming of Age in Second Life, which was an ethnography of people who play Second Life, but it was an ethnography that was completely set within the game. That's like straight up virtual ethnography. That's not so popular anymore. It was challenged quite significantly afterwards by people who said, but what about people's offline context? They don't just exist in a like, in an online space as if identity markers are meaningless. So mostly when people talk about digital ethnography, they might be talking about studies that are just of online phenomena, but they're also considering who the person is behind the computer or the technology. Quite often it will be a combination of online and offline ethnography, as is what I'm doing. And then netnography, other people might have different opinions about this, but as far as I understand, netnography is a bit more, it's Kozinets, right, who's based at USC over in LA, and it's more of a like market research approach, I think. What discipline does he come from? Does anyone know? I think he's comes from like a kind of business management discipline. So I think that he has written his stuff on ethnography, probably shares a lot of the same stuff with all those other methods, but it's more geared towards a kind of pragmatic, like, how can we learn things about people as consumers, and then perhaps maybe more what Kaelin does, I guess. I don't know if you're familiar with his work. No,
I'm not. And yeah, I mean, honestly, for me, netnography is not a term that I come across.
Yeah, but it's, once again, it's kind of like it's sort of a perhaps slightly arbitrary disciplinary divide. The name of the researcher, Kozinets, Kozinets. Kozinet. Oh, is there no S? Kozinet, sorry. Yeah. As far as I know, that's how I understand the distinctions between those different terms. I don't know if that's useful.
Yeah, and I think that was definitely a better explanation than I would have given. I do think that, yeah, for me, really, like, remote ethnography is one that stands out as like doing research, digitally kind of mediated research, but it kind of seems like Zoom and stuff like that, just from like you know, remote meetings and remote ethnography, and trying to, I guess, maybe get like video material and aspects like that. Whereas, yeah, I think the other ones, it's more about the subject, whether it's kind of cyberspace as a subject or digital platforms as a subject. But no, I think Zoe's overview was.
Yeah, actually, that's a really good point. And I would add that if you look at, the digital anthropology group at UCL, for example, who run, you know, they have their masters and stuff, their approach is much more like, I would say, traditional. I also come from an anthropology background, by the way, just to be clear, but it's much more sort of traditional anthropology, but looking at digital technologies. And they still call that digital anthropology. They're kind of going to a place and looking at how people use digital technologies, which is very different in a sense from what I do, which is kind of looking at internet culture. I would say that's quite a significant distinction. And I think that for a lot of you, that probably is quite an important question. Like, if you're thinking about turning your research into some sort of digital ethnographic study, that works really well for some subjects, for some types of research, but it doesn't really work well for other types. So depending on what your project is, you know, I'm trying to think of examples off the top of my head, but like, let's say if you were going to go and do a bit more of a traditional, like, ooh, what's that? Oh, the violin. So I just realized what that was. If you were planning to do something like more what the people at UCL do, which is like go to a place and see how people use technology, for example, obviously you wouldn't be able to do that in the current situation. And the questions might not translate well into an online research project.
I think Eivor has done a couple of ethnographies. Eivor, can you give us a bit about your experience with conducting ethnographies, please?
Yeah, sure. So the first ethnography that I was involved with was looking at online communities and looking at healthcare behavior online. And so this is research that it's now published, but initially we were interested in the knowledge sharing, knowledge translation question. How do patients help each other, and what value is that knowledge? Does it actually benefit them, or is it dangerous knowledge? A lot of the medical profession or the healthcare professions feel that if a patient is giving another patient advice, it might be poorly placed advice, maybe this is harmful. So that was our kind of our motivation at a sort of practical level about why we wanted to study these online communities. So we actually participated in those communities. They're open to the public. So we became members of this sort of diabetic interest group in the one case, and rheumatoid arthritis. You can declare your participation, and anybody could have participated. And we had ethics for this was a part of the data collection of a wider study. It was a startup technology firm that we were following, and this was their sort of value proposition, was to provide an online forum, a little bit like Patients Like Me, but in contradistinction to Patients Like Me. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that group, but it is trying to match people with a partner that has a similar disease profile to them. But this was really to allow people to talk about their issues together in a forum, a little bit like Facebook, but not with your friends and family, but rather with people who had a similar interest in health that you did. So we collected the digital traces left by these sort of, you could call them, they're not patients, they're just users. So we call them the community users. So they're online community participants. But we also then, we kept the digital traces and looked at what kinds of things they were learning from each other. We also were looking at the moderation processes and trying to understand the organizing and how that facilitated knowledge translation or not. We shifted the focus of our study because we actually found what was more interesting was the way that they changed the platform to create new forms of value, and how that then changed the participation of the communities, and also how new stakeholders could participate in different ways because of the platform. So we were interested in the platform dynamics and the kinds of stakeholder value that could be generated, patient or they're not patients, so community users being one of them, or the people caring about their health. But the key challenge in an online community is that you start them, but 3 months later, nobody's participating anymore. So how do you generate an ongoing participation was our interest. And the other netnography that I participated in was actually through one of my doctoral students, and she was studying, you could consider this a form of how social movements are created in online contexts, and was looking at really the facilitation processes behind getting members of the public to contribute ideas, shape ideas, change their point of view, and in some way gather a type of collective action through an online participation. But of course, this is not random participation. There is important facilitation going on. And there are, what we were interested there was how we use different technologies to facilitate different kinds of participation. So the participation in Twitter is not the same as in Instagram, for example, but the same community might use both of these mediums. So we were interested in how the different forms of technology shape the online participation. Again, looking at the digital traces, and then the output of this was some form of media product. So a television series, for example, but with changes in the real world. So in some of these cases, actual laws were changed as a result of partial result of these events. So we were trying to assess the change, but really studying the processes of the digital activity through online traces, which included interviewing some of the participants in whatever medium they were engaging in. So if it was Twitter, then we could interview them back to Twitter, because these are open forums, if they were interested in doing so.
Yeah. I wanted to add something. Some of the earliest experiments of ethnography, like Bonnie Nardi's work on mass online gamings, she used to use this double thing. She used to start online and then go offline, and this is something to keep in mind for the future. So the two can be combined. You establish contacts online, and then later, when the COVID has settled down a little bit, you can reach people and go to talk to them in person. Avery, somebody asked if you actually had insiders in your, so some of your people from your team were members. So if they were diabetes patients, or were you a complete outsider?
So we were insiders with the tech firm. So we knew the people who were trying to develop this platform, and so they told us how to access. The platform is now widely used and is on the NHS, which is the English National Health System. It's on there, if you call for an emergency 111, this is one of the portals they'll send you to, is to go and talk to a community of people who have whatever it is you're trying to assess. So we watched, our access was from the tech firm, and so therefore we knew the moderators and we found out how to join. And in the sense of the other online community, we were complete outsiders. So the doctoral student really found access by engaging in that community as the participant herself.
So this is a question from Harry. Harry asked, so you didn't have any researcher who was also diabetic? So
no, I guess the reason why we took the diabetic was because we had somebody on the team I have family members who have diabetes, so I had interest, and another member of the team had somebody in their family who had rheumatoid issues, so they had an interest. So we joined teams that made sense, and that we could feel that we could follow the participation and in some sense be genuine. Some of these groups were closed, so the depression group and some of the groups, it wasn't possible for public to just join. So we had some connection, but we weren't participating as the other users. So in a sense, we were watching. You could call us the lurkers. That's some of the language that's used in the sort of cyber world. We were more as lurkers because we didn't contribute actively, but we were interested in the topic. That's why we chose that topic as opposed to another topic like Asperger's carers. We didn't have an interest in that topic, so we didn't choose that one. We follow two groups.
We have another member on the call who has experience of ethnography. Do you want to come in? I don't know if I don't want to call people out.
Yeah, I think it was me.
Yeah, are you Daniela?
Yes.
Yes, welcome.
Hi, y'all. Thank you. Actually, I was just wondering about ethnography because I had experience applying ethnography as an exploratory method, because actually it was on Facebook and it was to better understand users from a specific product. So we were analyzing how people interact with photographies, and the Facebook, it was the better, or actually a good environment to do this ethnography. And based on the results, it was possible to plan the next methods. So then we applied presentially methods. We applied focus groups and what else? And interviews, I think. But actually it was for on industry. It was for a specific product. So I think it's a good method to start.
Thank you. In one of the in one of the resources that I really urge you to look, which is actually at the end of the document, which has been put together by Professor Lupton from Australia, who also gave an extremely interesting webinar. And again, the link is at the end of the documents. And she makes a difference between those who were conducting born digital research, so those who are using ethnography, or like Zoe, who's been doing digital research all the time, and those who had to transform their methods into digital ones, so because of the externality, so to speak. So if it's okay, we'll stick and add a little bit about the born digital content. So I go back, and then we go back to what people did in order to transition. So people like Callan and everybody else, what have you done, you know, when. So Zoe, a few things. Zoe, whoever has information about this. So first of all, what is the, for those of us, and there are a lot of people I know and a lot of people I don't know, but who are traditional ethnographers. So we're relying on the old style, being there, doing there, with some other tricks on the side, but mostly that. So if you have to give some suggestions, sort of like digital ethnography 101, okay, so tip and tricks. Well, is there anything that you will suggest for people who have to learn this really quickly? Not from books, just for your experience.
Really quickly. I think it really depends what you're studying, obviously. But I think there's a big difference between projects that are... So when I'm talking about digital ethnography, I'm basically talking about studies of the internet in some way. I study social media, and I expect a lot of that's what a lot of people will be thinking about now. If they're thinking about doing online ethnography, it's going to be probably to do with some form of social media, as we study the social as anthropologists. But tips and tricks, I mean, my approach has always been to just much like I think people, there's been so many conversations about the difference between online and offline ethnography, and a lot of resistance in particularly in anthropology to doing online ethnography. But I don't see there being that much difference in the sense that you are that the same principles apply, and that you're spending a lot of time in a place in order to understand the world from the point of view of your participants. You know, that's always been what ethnography is about, and that same principle can easily apply in a digital context. So it really does depend on what your question is. I think there's a big difference between doing research that's on one platform or one website and doing cross-platform research. When I started, my project was just about YouTube and YouTube creators, and luckily I mean not luckily not coincidentally, I had spent already about 12 years spending a lot of my time on YouTube. So I was already very familiar with the culture of the platform. But when I started the research, I realized very quickly that I would have, it didn't make sense to do a project that was about one platform, because a significant part of the lives and work of YouTube creators is that they work across different platforms. That's like a core aspect of their jobs. They cultivate visibility across multiple platforms. So at that point I switched and started, you know, following certain people across different platforms and looking at how they kind of brought different platforms together and how they interacted with their audiences differently on different platforms and how their audiences communicated with them differently on different platforms, for example. It's a lot more simple if you're looking at one platform, but I think there's a main thing there, which is like, are you looking at a particular group or are you looking at a particular cultural phenomenon? So if you're looking at, like, for example, someone who works in my department, Shani Orgad, she did a study actually for her PhD a long time ago, which was about a particular breast cancer group online. So it was a very specific forum that she was studying, and she looked at how they interacted with each other and she got involved in the conversations. It's an ethical question, and so there's a lot that has been written about this from the ethics perspective, but just on a purely kind of sort of methodological level, it's not really fundamental to ethnography is participant observation. So what it means to participate online is different than what it means to participate offline. It's actually comes back to what Eva was saying, because it's, there's a lot of what is done online is observation. So like kind of that lurking thing. And if you're not participating, maybe it's a bit semantic, but like arguably it's not really ethnography because you're not participating. So I guess that's also a fundamental question. Like, do you want to be a participant observer? And if you want to be a participant observer, what activities do you have to do in order to actually participate? Is it appropriate for you to participate? It might not be appropriate if you're in certain groups. For example, the medical example is a good one. If you're studying a group of people who have a particular illness and you don't have that illness, then there's an ethical question there. Sorry, I feel like I'm rambling a bit at this point, but there's a lot of things going on that you have
Paola Borghi is asking, how do you conceive the terms of continuity and presence? So you make a distinction between presence and participations in these online forums?
Yes. Yeah, I would. Okay. I think that this is something that's been talked about in lots of literature, but in terms of traditional ethnography of like, what does it mean to participate? But in an offline setting, you're kind of just participating by being there, like by existing physically. People know you're there. You're kind of part of the social moment, whether or not you're doing a particular activity. In an online setting, people don't know you're there unless you do something quite a lot of the time.
This actually connects with the ethical question that Katarina is asking. So this is also for Eivor. Eivor, did you let the people know that you were actually participating? So again, do you disclose yourself as a researcher or you're just a lurker?
I can answer first, but I think it depends, different people have different answers, but it's very important that people know that you're there. As with any research project, there's extensive, in fact, I can share various resources, but the Association of Internet Researchers has a very useful document, which is like ethics in internet research. They're on their third, it's 3.0, their third version at the moment. That's my go-to document for thinking about ethics with online research. But basically, there are a lot of problems with doing research if the participants don't know that you're there.
Okay.
That's kind of like the short answer. But it depends on the privacy of the group. So if it's a private Facebook group, you definitely cannot collect data without getting consent. If it's an open platform like YouTube, it's a bit more of a gray area because it's like public stuff or like Twitter, and it can be very hard to get consent because you don't necessarily have a way to contact people. So that's a bit more of a gray area, but you should always try to get consent if you can.
Eivor?
Yeah, so in our context, the platform was new. And so we were actually working with the tech firm to help them understand how to develop their platform and how to facilitate engagement. So when the platform was opening, we actually came in as sort of under the guise of being part of the technical team. And the people who participated in the online community were aware that the organization who was hosting the platform, that they were doing research to look at how the processes were evolving, what sort of moderation was needed, what kind of participation was emerging. And so the group was told that this is happening. So we weren't the only people who were watching the platform in that sense, because the whole company, all of the members, the CEO, the medical director, there were a lot of people who were interested to know what was going on in this platform. And so they were aware that this was a group who were there. And that was our basis. That was, in a sense, our access and how we put it to the ethics committee. So that was, it's a little different if we had come in as complete outsiders. We weren't. We were coming in with the handholding, I suppose, of the CEO and the medical director. Or advice on
one last question to you and Zoe. So on the same topic, Zoe and Eva, how do you handle the formal aspect of ethical approval? Eleanor was asking, you know, what do you repeat people? If you have a forum, people come and go, how many times do you tell people? Do you send them forms? I mean, how do you handle the practicalities?
Well, you know, I think a lot of it depends on what you're doing with the data and what you're actually looking for. And it depends, I think, also on what point in time you do the research. So I think that what you do in 2020 is probably different from, well, we were looking at our startup, it was 2009. That was before GDPR. The process is an evolving process and an emerging process, and there are new technologies happening all the time. The kind of, for example, market research that companies are often looking for, that, you know, there is always a bit of a gray area in that sense as to what is the company allowed to procure in order to know how to develop their technology, if it's a new technology, that sort of market research at some level. So there's a lot of gray areas and it changes over time. So I don't think it's necessarily an easy question. And it also depends, I think, on what you do with the data. And I guess the overall thing from my point of view is that one has to be very clear on one's own ethical standards about what's happening with the data. Is there any way to inconvenience, harm, or in any way expose anybody? Or is this, or you know, it could be that if the data is being used to aggregate, for example, turn-taking, it actually isn't exposing anyone to anything. So it's not worth flagging to everybody, oh, by the way, we're watching your turn taking every day, because that would then influence the process. So it really depends on what you're looking at, what you're doing with the data. And that's what ethics committees are for. They are supposed to help you scrutinize your own ethics and keep you on your toes to make sure that what you're doing is above board.
Yeah, I would agree. Those are all good points. Same, I would say a lot of the same things. I would just add that with online research, much ethnography specifically, much like with offline ethnography, you need to get informed consent. And I think that like the informed part is the bit that is often difficult, because whether it's online or offline ethnography, people don't always understand what ethnographic research is and what it looks like in the end. So it's kind of an ongoing process of gaining consent. You know, it doesn't have to be, it probably won't be written consent with, if you're studying like an online community, you don't need to have a form that someone has signed, but it's kind of just making sure that you're checking in regularly and telling people that you're there without trying to make it awkward, which is a difficult balance, you know, to try not to disrupt the social situation that you're in. For me, with my research, I thought a lot about this because it was challenging across different platforms and offline to like combine these different things. And what I ended up doing was mostly using the people who I had interviewed directly in offline settings. I'm mostly using like them as my case studies. There's enough of them that it's like plenty. And I chose them, you know, because I thought their content was interesting, which makes the consent issue easier because they have given me very direct consent to use the interviews. And then I also added a part to the consent form, which was like, you are happy, I'm happy for Zoe to use my interview transcript in correlation with my online presence, my online content, which means that I don't have to check every time I want to reference a video or something. But with the comments section, it depends what you're looking at. Different platforms have different issues, as I said before, but with comment sections on, let's say, like YouTube or any public social media platform, it's really important to remember that the comments are searchable, so you can't actually anonymize. It's not enough to just change the name. Like if I want to use a direct quote from someone's comment, it's arguable whether that's okay or not. Some people think it's fine because it's on a public platform, but I would say, you know, along the same lines, if it's about something sensitive, I think it's ethically dubious to just take a comment without getting consent, and you would have to rephrase it. You couldn't just change the name if you actually wanted to anonymize it.
Actually, I had to do the same. Recently, we had the same things in a recent paper in JAS. We reported a forum discussion. So because we were criticizing them, we had to severely rephrase so it couldn't be traced. Sorry, Jackie Anderson.
Yep, that's me. I'm here.
Hi, Jackie. You were saying that you also had some experience on this.
I wasn't intending to use the Facebook groups, which I managed, which I set up 4 years ago. That was going to be for my research for next year, but because I wanted to back up some of my face-to-face interviews, I was going to see if I could use some of the topic discussions I've been leading as a lead of the group, to back up what I'm currently doing. But because that hasn't been part of my original proposal, I'm not sure about how where I stand ethically. I do have on the top of the group an announcement that says, you know, if you are okay with me using any of your comments, I take it that if you haven't inboxed me to say don't, but that's because I wasn't going to use the comments if you're with me at the minute. If I go back and perhaps individually ask them, could I use their comments? Obviously, it's not anonymized or anything. I'm only looking at maybe 4 or 5 people's comments, but I feel a bit, you know, dodgy about using it, really.
Zoe, we need to move on. But will you post? Can you post the reference to the Associations of Internet Research Ethical Things on the?
Yeah.
And I want to tell everybody that we will download the chat, okay, and make it available. Henry, is it okay if I bypass your questions, because I want to move to the second one? So we said this word, we were discussing what I would call native digital approaches, so born digital. So how about how people transitioned from traditional things to online? So what have you done? So Callan, maybe you can tell what your company does normally, and how have you transitioned? Because I think that's a question, practical questions for a lot of people in this forum. Zoe started digital, so she knows a lot about digital, but she's staying digital. So for her, the world has not collapsed. For many of us, you know, there are people who are doing shadowing, people who are doing observed meetings. So how have you transitioned? And the same question to everybody else.
Yeah, so like at the most kind of basic level, a lot of the research is fairly straightforward interviews. So those we typically go into the market and meet people you know, at their home or at their place of work, and do an interview for a couple of hours. And so those we've just switched to doing on Zoom, on Google Hangouts, and having people do those over video. And for the most part, you know, so far it's worked relatively well for, you know, an interview. I think you don't have as much time. People tend to get a bit more tired over video than they do when you're in a room together. So we've stuck to kind of 90 minutes as our length for those interviews. But yeah, where it's more of a struggle and you're really missing something are the aspects of really immersing and observing. And, you know, we often try to find activities to do in the field, whether that's going to meetings or going to events or doing activities with our participants. And the ways that we've tried to, you know, approach that is kind of trying to get a bit creative with how what we ask people to do. And so having kind of activities to do on video, whether it's giving us a tour of something, but also kind of diary style studies, which are like fairly common in applied research anyway, because they're more affordable. But kind of asking people to upload photos of things over the week and kind of describe as they have certain interactions or certain experiences, you know, over the course of a week to you know, communicate with a researcher, often over WhatsApp or a similar platform, and collect data that way. So that's one thing that we're doing, and often kind of combining the two. So doing a diary study in the first instance, asking them to kind of collect instances over time or record videos in advance. Then that kind of gives us an initial glimpse into some aspect of their life and also the kind of visual artifacts that come from photos and video. But then to follow up when we have an interview.
Let me ask you one, just to expand a little bit on this. As it happened, I know a little bit about your work. So the one difference between some of the companies like yours and what most of the people on these groups is that you sometimes use some agencies to recruit participants, right? Which is something that for academics is still relatively unusual. It's becoming a little bit more usual, but it's unusual. So the question is that I imagine that you tell people in advance there's going to be a diary because these people are paid. Is that correct? And so how would you, do you have anything to suggest for people like us who all of a sudden have to invent ways of supplement our stuff? You know, how do we ask people to do tasks offline? Because participant observation is difficult to start because people are really suspicious at the beginning. But once you're in, people realize that you don't create any further work. And that's, do you have any suggestions?
I mean, it is true that we always pay our respondents, so people do always get something out of participating and in return for their time spent. I don't know to what extent, you know, people would have a kind of appetite or willingness to do it without that, but I do imagine, you know, for example, the person who said they're kind of doing the study of young musicians, you know, if you kind of get a group of friends to do something together, there also might be, you know, more appetite to do that if it can be done in a group or if people know that others around them are doing it. So where there has been some kind of contact and access initiated, that might be a possibility. I suppose also there's kind of thinking about ways that, you know, other than financial incentives, but things that can be, you know, offered otherwise in terms of kind of, you know, giving people something in appreciation for their time. But I mean, I guess the other point is that, we always try to make it as easy as possible for people. So, I mean, that's something where kind of sharing photos is something that people are really used to doing. And, you know, we've started, even before this, we were experimenting with, you know, letting people just record voice memos and voice notes to kind of respond to things that way so that they don't need to be writing things up. And so we do always try to make something as easy as possible and kind of give people a few activities to do, you know, that they can complete sitting down for 20 minutes or 30 minutes. And I think the point on that is that, you know, that's not going to be the kind of the bulk of the substance of the research, and it shouldn't be viewed as, you know, the main kind of method. But it's also, I mean, I think this is a time to be open to seeing what we get from things and kind of having a bit of familiarity and kind of a chance for serendipity in what you might find, and kind of viewing it as a complementary method to interviews or when you wind up being able to get into the field in person.
Yeah. This is a question to you, but also to the rest of the participants. I had a lot of discussions with my some of my colleagues about gifts, which is, according to anthropology, is an all discussion, right? So you do bring gift, and what does the gift does to your relationships? So let's talk about inducement. Some of the questions that we had before the session were, you know, about how do you stay in touch with the people? How do you convince people to, as I said, to engage digitally that create some work? So if you or anybody else has any suggestions about this, you know, do you offer inducement? How do you convince people? As I said, participant observation has the benefit that it doesn't require an inducement because you do all the work. Once people let you in, they don't have to do anything. Do you have any suggestions, any experience, personal experience, do and don'ts? I have, just give you an example. I have a friend, an ex-student who swears about bringing cookies, brownies. A lot of people in the club will know who I'm talking about. He made a case of bringing brownies everywhere. And he's, you know, he did a 2 years ethnography, and in the company was, oh, it's the brownie guys.
That's great. I would say, obviously it depends on where you're coming from, and I think how long the project is has a really big impact on that. So I have never given anything material for participating. But I feel that because my fieldwork is very long term, I'm building up, you know, relationships with my participants, and that's kind of a lot of my access has come from building up trust, basically, which is, of course, a long-standing thing in any ethnographic work. It is made easier by the fact that I am doing offline research as well. So people, you know, I meet people face-to-face, I bump into them at events repeatedly, so they know who I am. But I also sustain and build a lot of that kind of trust and familiarity through just ongoing online engagement with my participants on YouTube and Twitter and Instagram and stuff like that. And I think that if you have time, you know, if you're doing a long-term ethnographic project, then that's okay. Like, that's kind of enough reward in the sense that you're like, you might not be like friends in the normal sense, but you're kind of, they know what you're doing, and presumably they're kind of interested in what you're doing, and they kind of are happy to give you their time because you're part of the culture that you're studying. But it's very different if you're doing like a short-term project where it's a bit more, I don't know what the right word is, but you're kind of, you need an answer quickly, you know, you're trying to get data quickly, which is probably more what Kaelin is talking about in his work. You're muted.
Ida, do you want to ask your question instead of me asking all the questions?
I can do. this my question is, if we're talking about gifts and incentives for the participants, it can also work the other way around. that some people that you deal with in the field start, as it were, bribing you because they have their agenda that they would like to bring into the project. So I think we might also want to talk about that, because I think both sides of that coin are problematic.
I just took notice, this can be a great topic for a whole session of our ethnography circle, maybe the next digital one.
I agree, and I'd be happy to contribute in any way that you might consider useful.
Yeah, it's very
obviously
useful.
Obviously, I'm speaking of from a bit of experience in that regard.
Do you want to tell us about the experience?
I can. Some time ago, I was doing work on what we called values programs in educational settings. And one of the groups that had produced one of those packages started to do what I would say caught me. So I was invited to events, of course, which I wanted to be part of as a participant observer, but I was sort of treated like a VIP person. And I would have rather sat at the back of the room and just pretended I wasn't there, rather than sit in the front row and be sort of a fated guest. And that made the relationships a bit tricky because I had to negotiate all that. So it wasn't, if you like, a gift in kind. Sorry, it wasn't a gift in terms of material things, but it was a gift in terms of treatment and in kind, in the sense of making my connections with the group more important than I would have liked them to be. I hope that gives you a bit of an idea of what I'm talking about.
Right. Yeah. But I had an experience 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, last time I went to, I was participating, observing an event. And in the middle of the event, I was doing a quiet observations in the corner. I was invited. So, and in the middle of the event, the chair identified me and asked me to point it at me. So, by the way, we have the researcher here. And what happened is because part of the reason for this event was to raise the profile of the organization.
Yeah.
I basically was enrolled in the project. So I was the award, because if I pointed at me and telling, oh, this, we have a professor from University of Warwick, all of a sudden the prestige of the things at being, I added the prestige of my institution, the prestige of the things. And I think that's one of the things like you happens a lot of the time. Yeah. You are tacitly enrolled in some of the interests of these things. Yes. But as I said, we leave this for another time, but it would be interesting to talk also about explicit inducement. So bringing gifts, you know, promising the rewards. We had in the past in the circle, we had sessions about what you do at the end of a project, you know, what you promise to give back. So we can go back to that. Ila?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the things that I wanted to discuss, and this is something that some of the participants have asked as well, is care for research participants during the crisis. And, you know, there are organizations, for example, who are overworked, or in my personal case, I have to work with healthcare workers. And then the question is, well, is it morally okay to approach these people at this time? How do you engage with them? How do you approach them? How do you make sure you're not overburdening them, etc.? And I was wondering, and this is again an open question to everyone who has experience with this, how do you deal with those issues?
I could speak to this first, maybe. I think it's a really important question, and it actually comes back to what Davide was saying at the beginning about Twitter, or to the Twitter thing you thought you were involved with. My opinion, and I know people have different opinions about how to deal with the current situation, but my opinion is that as an ethnographer, it's really important to consider the care of your participants and of yourself. So, I mean, I don't think anyone would disagree with that, but what that means, maybe people might disagree about at the moment. My feeling is that whilst it's really important to study what's happening at the moment, it's obviously, no one would disagree that it's an important moment culturally and socially and in many, many other ways. It is also not a moment to kind of exploit the situation for research gains. And obviously that's like a loaded term, exploit. But I really do feel like there's kind of a pressure to just like jump on the situation and to have something to say about it straight away and to have great data. And, you know, there's so many opportunities to collect data at the moment. But I think that we need to be very careful as social researchers that we are looking after ourselves and others. And sometimes that might mean not collecting data. You know, some of the projects that we maybe are already doing, we might not have to carry on doing because people don't want to talk to a researcher at the moment about whatever it was about before, or maybe they don't want to talk, they don't want to start talking about how coronavirus has impacted their lives, you know. So it's difficult for us because there's so many pressures on researchers to be productive and to always be coming up with new things to say, and it's an exciting time to look at what's happening. But I think, we need to be careful not to just kind of sort of take advantage of the moment.
Would anyone else like to add from their experience about research participants and organizations, approaching research participants and organizations at this time?
I can, if you like. Oh, sorry. I work at the medical school, so I do a lot of health research as well. And I've been working on a bid. So we're not actually doing the research yet, but we're trying to get funding for it to look at people's experiences of making decisions, like clinical decisions in the COVID pandemic. And I guess all I had to say was that we've done kind of PPI, so if you like, so speaking to the potential healthcare professional group, like representatives from those groups, because we really didn't want to overburden them. And a lot of the response we've had has been, you know, we actually want to talk about our experiences, especially because we want to look at like ethical dilemmas and things. So I think it really depends on your topic and who you're speaking to. And we've kind of made the decision to not speak to certain groups like intensive care doctors because they're probably super busy. But then other groups actually, funnily enough, have less work than they did before the pandemic. So I think it just, like with all of these things, it just depends on who you're doing the work with and who the participants are. That's not ethnographic work, so I guess that's a bit different. It would just be interviews, but I just thought I'd jump in. That was helpful.
Awesome. Thank you. Can I ask, we are running out of time. There are a couple of questions that I would ask really where we can use the collective wisdom here. A lot of people are worried about the academic consequences. Colin, sorry for this, but you know, sort of, you've been here as well. So you are in the middle of your research. You have a hold for 6 months of your research. Or you have to change the data collections as you go along. So how do you justify this? Do you incorporate the evaporations of the fieldwork in your analysis? Did you submit some changes in your plan? How have you solved these problems practically? Anybody? because there is nobody knows what works or doesn't at the moment. So
I would say be open and transparent about your data, and also mention how the current situation or anything, like if you lose data, that happens as well. Just be open about it and work with the data you have got, and not agonize about the data you haven't got, because that at least your data are then in context and everybody who deals with your project knows where to place it and what your contribution is given the circumstances.
Ida, what would you put this? Would you put this in a dissertation or in your paper? So we will see papers that said I started the research and then I had to change halfway, take this into account in the methodology section. I mean, practically yes. Speaking, how do you see this happening?
I would put it in my methodology and it could go, for example, under the limitations. I've examined MA dissertations where it was very, very clear that something went wrong with the recording of the interviews and the candidate did not own up to that calamity. It's happened to me. I came home with interviews not recorded. You just say, I had a technical problem. I've got a gap in my data. I can't make it up. At another time when that happened, I could redo the interviews. But sometimes you can't, and just own up, be ethical in being transparent. That's what I would say.
Davide, can I say something?
Sure.
Eivor. I also think that it really depends on where you're, if it's PhD research, in a particular like a UK context where there's a bit of a time pressure to finish, if there's a funding issue where your funding runs out. So my three pieces of advice, I'm the PhD director at Warwick Business School. So this is particularly the advice to anybody here who's in Warwick Business School doing your PhD. You really need to brainstorm carefully about what is practical. You need to do that, I would say, get a group of people that you can speak to about it, because as Davide says, we don't really know the answers. We need to work our way forward. But I do think it's important not to feel that you're going to do that in isolation. So if you're a doctoral researcher, certainly there will be chat groups out there that have been referred to here in the group chat, but also speak to your supervisors, speak to other people who have who are in your cohort or group, and look for solutions. And I don't think there will be a one size fits all, but I know I have one student who was going to do ethnography and then she switched to doing online interviews of a completely different topic, but can use some of the literature build up from before, not a completely different topic, but there are pragmatic ways to deal with it. But I would say, don't try to go it alone and feel the stress. And I think the other thing is to try to be practical, and there is data being collected. And so if it's not the project that you had dreamed of, then one of the things you can do is to think of that, after your PhD, if the world gets back to normal, then you could maybe resume the project you wanted to do. But at this point, you need to do the project that the practicalities afford. And so there is a level of being practical in taking this step forward and in dealing with what Davide says, how do you manage this? And that, again, it's important to take that forward with your supervisors. But the other thing I would also say is that, there are possibly opportunities here that you hadn't anticipated. So you could, if you can come over the fact that you can't do what you thought you were gonna do, and rather see this as, what are the opportunities here? And I'm not saying to jump on the COVID bandwagon per se, but look at the options around you creatively. You might find that there's a whole new data source that you can learn about and use, bring in some discourse analysis. There's a lot of visual data now available, lots of webinars. How do pictures influence what's going on if you're looking at organizational processes? There are a lot of ways that we can tap in to our research context that we hadn't thought of before, and you might be able to bring in an angle like that, depending, of course, on where you are at in the PhD process.
Can I also ask the other question around? So instead of seeing this as a threat, as something that makes it more difficult, see it also as an opportunity. Like, what does the situation give us that we are forced maybe to go remotely? But at some point, and for some countries, it might actually be quite soon, we also have to go all of a sudden to not remote anymore. And like, what new insights would it give to us that we have made both moves from all of a sudden we have to go to remote, and then all of a sudden, oh, we have to go back again? I'm like wondering like what these two moments could tell us about the research that we're doing. But I don't have an answer, so.
I think that's a really interesting point. And one of the things that kind of has come up in some of the research that we're doing is just the difference of speaking to people over video and how kind of some of the aspects, you know, that you often bring to in-person interaction, whether it's gender, class, race, you know, different aspects of your background, like are potentially a bit like flattened on video and maybe not as present. I think, you know, that might be something to keep in mind and just be thoughtful of, like the differences that you feel if when you're not kind of around people in person versus then when you go into being around them in person, like if you sense any changes in those dynamics, it could be pointing you towards something quite significant.
Good point, thank you.
Yeah, I also agree very much with the point that was made, is to see the different opportunities out there and not focus on the negatives, because there are aspects, especially in organizations, of things to study that that we hadn't thought of before, but now they might appear. So take advantage of it.
Right. Sophie, are you around? Sophie has put a nice post. Sophie Staniewska.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yeah. Hi.
Hi. Hello. Yes, I think we have a big transition happening around patient and public involvement and engagement in the UK and internationally, moving from face-to-face meetings predominantly where we co-produce research to a virtual set of interactions. And this is happening incredibly quickly. And I guess I'm trying to link up with people who have an interest or knowledge of how, when you move as a group together into a virtual setting, how that can work and how we replicate the conditions we know work well face-to-face into a virtual setting. So this is proving quite useful at the moment for some projects that are national and international, where I was really wondering how on earth we were going to actually achieve that move. But it suddenly impacted on the local projects where people really like to meet together and discuss with us. And those interactions are so important in terms of keeping a good dynamic and trust and high quality relationships. So this is across the whole of our sector. And it's, I think we're sort of looking at it as a time of opportunity, but also a time of worry, because we see a lot of studies going through ethical approval without the public involvement that certainly the HRA, our regulatory body, would like us to have to ensure their quality. So it's sort of so many changes at the same time. And, you know, we're interested in exploring that. So I just put that note on. I know it's a bit different from what we've been talking about, but please do get in touch if this is an area of interest or you have knowledge. I'd really like to find out more about what you've all done.
The reason why I think instead your company is extremely interesting is because one of the, for ethnographers or for anthropologists, one of the opportunities that I think the pandemics will give is that it will be a natural experiment of the difference between offline and online. There's been a lot of work, mostly speculative or small researches about the differences between online and offline interactions. I've done a review recently because I had to write something for a newspaper that then didn't publish it, but that's another story. The truth is that we know very little because all this was done in a very short scale. So, you know, for people who make a profession out of interacting directly, so participant observation, you know, so what happens when you start moving things? It's going to be a topic of first of research and then something that we'll have to learn very quickly.
Yeah.
We know that, and then this is just to go back to Zoe at the beginning, one of the problems that ethnographers of work like me have been experienced for the last 10 years is that work has done multimodal. So people work seamlessly between online and offline. And if you don't follow them offline and online, you don't understand what they do. Because, you know, 25, 30 years ago, you go in a factory, you observe people doing things. Now, if you go in a factory, you look at, or in an office, you look at people watching at a screen, which is not very telling. Okay, so you know, so this, it's going to be a very interesting conversations, exactly for the reasons you just said. So this is one of the topics that in the future will.
I'd just add to that though, I think a lot of people are coming to this question of what it means to do ethnography online now because of the current moment, but this is an area that has been studied for 30 years at this point, and like there are it's kind of a niche in, or at least in anthropology it's quite a niche, but it is quite a growing field, and there's a special issue. I'm going to share the link in the thing because there was a special issue recently on digital ethnography on a particular journal, and it had a really, really useful literature review of the history of digital ethnography, basically. And I think that anyone who's wanting to get into this area would find it useful in terms of like the key readings going on. But yeah.
Okay. So before we bring this to a close, I'll pass again the turn to Ila. I wanted to say that one of the participants who identifies himself or herself as U1672761 has asked very pressingly about suggestion on how to do phone interviews, so ethical and practical suggestions on doing phone interviews. I don't know how we can contact him or her because we don't have a name. But if anybody wants to help, maybe you can identify on the chat and then this person can contact you directly. Should we do like that? We left a little bit behind because it will take us in a different directions at our conversations, but it's something really relevant. Is okay? I don't know. Okay, yes, thank you. Ila?
Perfect. Well, I think that's where we close the session. Thank you all very, very much for joining us, and especially thank you to Zoe, Callan, and Eivor for sharing your experiences. Hopefully next year we will be able to do some form of the ethnography circle, either online or offline, and we will keep you all posted on how that goes. Thank you very, very much for joining. And I will save the chat and the recording and share it with everyone.
Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.